This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Today's episode of Gilmore Guys is brought to you by Squarespace. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code Gilmore Guys to get 10% off your first purchase. You want to build a website yourself, but you don't know CSS or HTML. Well, fear not, Squarespace will give you what you need. If you sign up for a year, get a domain for free. Got beautiful templates and winning designs and tools made for commerce with the user in mind. From the national brands to the small local stores, everybody's using Squarespace to open their doors. If you need further help, that's fine. At any hour of the day, they've got support online, and they'll help with any issue, no matter how small it is. So if you've got a problem, well, it's not the apocalypse. If you want building a site to be easy, or you want to customize it openly and freely, or you want to sell stuff, well, you know where to start. Use Squarespace to set your website apart. If you're stuck using a gross old razor, your body will thank you if you change your behavior. Shaving poorly is a mistake made commonly, but Harry's wants to change it up and give you some quality. I've tried Harry's razors myself, and they're incredible. I get a closer shave, and I stay looking sensible. My face feels smooth, it's no longer insufferable. Harry's makes shaving super easy and comfortable. They've got a great starter set known as the Truman. It's only 15 bucks. You won't believe what they threw in. A handle, 3 razors, and moisturizing shave cream. Harry's wants to make shaving feel like a dream. You can also get 5 bucks off your first purchase with the code Gilmore Guys. You can shave with purpose. Go to harrys.com, harrys.com. With Harry, shave better, spend less.
Go high.
Ba, 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 ba. Ba, ba, ba.
Buster. Oh. Buster's an honorary guy. He's basically the third season,
Buster,
the seventh season co-host.
He's like our Paul Anka.
I think so.
He doesn't have as many quirks, though.
Oh, thank the Lord. Yeah. Welcome to Gilmore Guys. I'm Kevin.
I'm Demi.
And we're the Gilmore Guys. Back at it again in Stude. This is our first episode we're recording without the infamous brick wall. Yeah. So that's something. That's a little thing.
Rest in peace.
RIP. Yeah, we poured one out. We poured one all over. We smashed our bottles up against the brick wall.
Which was a shame because we don't own the building. So.
No, so it was a big mess for the next guys to clean up, which is kind of a bummer. But
not
that's how
wall,
you gotta go
problem.
Out. And that address, once again, just kidding. Buster's really...
Buster is so antsy, which is fine. It's fine.
Buster's creating a situation for Demi.
Demi, I'm fine. I love it.
For some reason, Demi's the only one he barks at anymore.
And the only one whose face he's looking right now.
I guess so.
But enough about me.
Enough about Demi. Finally, enough about Demi. Guys, we're about to go out on the road for our tour. But before we did, we had to make a few stops back into the studio and take care of some business.
That's right.
And take some journeys and go down some roads and paths. Metaphorically, that is.
Yeah. I don't know where you're going with this.
Well, we're just talking about the journeys that we all go on.
Okay.
That we may not have seen coming, but at the end of the day, once we get there, we say, I'm glad I did that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Support me.
I'm supportive.
Do you think it's time to introduce our special guest?
I think it's time.
I want you to meet my special guest.
Okay.
La la.
Oh, yeah.
La la. A special guest.
Well, you may know him from, man, most of TV from the last 20 years. You may know him from Friends or Private Practice or any number series. And you may know him as Mr. Christopher Hayden from Gilmore Girls. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for David Sutcliffe.
What's up? Happy to be here. You guys are awesome.
You made it.
Thank you so much. You're awesome.
It's been a long time coming.
We have no joke been coordinating this basically for... over a year.
Well, I've been out of LA for 3.5 years.
You were in,
so
you were out.
I was out, yeah. But
what took you out of LA for so long?
Went back to Toronto, which is where I'm from. I was there for 3.5 years for work.
Okay.
I was doing a series up there for the CBC, which is Canadian television. And then I wrapped that up, and then I went out to Vancouver to do a series, Proof, with Jennifer Beals for TNT.
Okay.
Once that finished up, it was I was enough with Canada and the cold, and I decided it was time to come back to L.A.
Back to La La Land. Now, we may have a Buster. Chill. Chill, bro.
He's fine. He's good.
We may have a few questions for you because we are actually for the first time for both of us, yeah. right? We're about to go to Toronto.
The day this comes out, we'll yeah. be there.
Oh, really?
That's true. Yes. So, okay. yeah, we're going to Toronto, Canada for
a
little
live
show.
I can tell
you
all about Toronto.
Yeah, what name like two or three things that we must do when we're there?
Well, you got to go to Little Italy.
Okay.
That's like a cool scene down there on College Street West. Mm-hmm. Got to check that out, have some coffee. That's where the best coffee shops are. And then you want to head down to Parkdale, which is Queen Street West, the okay. Drake Hotel. There's a whole scene down there. And the great thing about Toronto, it's a great walking city. So you can see a lot of the city on foot, and you're going to be there in September, right? So
yeah, it'll be yeah. September 11th through like, yeah. We'll be there for a few days. Yeah.
Are you going to be there for the film festival?
We will be there concurrently, but not oh, for. Yes. We're just here for this
Might
show.
Well, you should try to go to some film festival party. Get okay. some connection and go, because those are the hot parties, and they're a lot of fun.
We'll use your name and tell everyone we know you.
I'm a Perfect. Friend of Sutcliffe.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh, right this way, sir.
That might work.
Pardon
that
me.
That might work. It might not. I can't be sure.
Oh, man. Well, we're very excited because we've both never been to Canada
right.
before, right? Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah.
So are you the only Canadian member of the Gilmore Girls cast?
Well, Yannick Truesdale is
of
from
course.
Montreal, so he's the
French
other one.
Canadian.
I'm not sure. There may be some more, but that's the only one I know for sure.
Okay, right on.
It's a big cast. I mean, a lot of reoccurring
really?
Characters.
I can't keep
track of them all. So it is like a Simpsons cast. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And what is the Christopher Hayden equivalent, the Simpsons? Sideshow Bob?
Well, now. No.
Mr. Burns?
Yes.
Skinner? Smithers?
Unfortunately, some fans would say it's Mr. Burns, but I like to believe he's just Homer, too.
They're different
Homer
sides
too.
Of the Homer
I don't
coin.
Like either of those.
What? Homer's beloved.
Who do you want to be?
Beloved.
You want to be Bart? You want to be...
I think he's probably a little... I mean, not, you know, his attitude is probably a little more Bart, yeah. I think.
And I would say... Mr. Sutcliffe, you're just as ageless as Bart for the last 20 years.
You're very
or
kind.
Or 26 years or however that show's been
you're
on
very
for.
Very kind.
So where'd you grew up in Toronto?
I was born in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay.
Which is just north of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my dad's side of the family is from. And then we moved to southern Ontario. So quite near Niagara Falls, Grimsby and St. Catharines, two little towns.
Okay.
It was kind of farmland area. We weren't farmers, but I grew up in the country. And then I went to University of Toronto, and then I started my acting career there.
Did you major in theater?
I majored in English Lit. I was actually a jock. I was growing up as a hockey player, and then in high school, I played basketball. And then while I was at U of T, I was on the varsity basketball team. And then I had an injury in my second season. I was living with a playwright, and he was producing plays, and I had now suddenly this free time because I wasn't playing basketball. So I said, hey, you know, can I give you a hand, do the lights? And he said, why don't you audition? And I thought about it, and I was like, all right, I'll audition. And he gave me a little part, and that was it. I got the acting bug, and it was a real replacement for the sports. You know, it was similar to me because you went and you practiced, which was the rehearsal, and then you would perform, which was like the game. So, you know, the structure of it felt familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something very, I don't know, creative, and I could feel I was just interested in it. And I wasn't really thinking about it as a career at first, but the more I got into it at university, I started, you know, directing theater and just doing more and more. And then when I graduated, there wasn't really anything else that I wanted to do. So I just thought I'd give it a shot. And so I started doing stuff in Toronto and eventually made my way first to New York very briefly and then out to L.A. In 1998.
In New York, were you doing a lot of stage stuff?
I wasn't. I went there thinking I might do that, but I got there and it was pilot season. I didn't even know what pilot season was at the mm-hmm. time. And I was in my late 20s, 28. And I was, you know, kind of cute, kind of funny. And Friends was like the big show on the air. So there was all kinds of roles for those kind of guys. So I was suddenly very castable. And
yeah, that must have been like a sort of boom in the 90s
yeah.
where it's like everyone was doing like, it's like Friends, but there's one more girl than there is boy. Like those kind of
yeah.
like knockoff shows.
There was a ton of them. And because I could play comedy... I was going out on a lot of stuff and testing for a lot of stuff. And I could just feel that was where my career was going. It made a lot more sense for me to be in LA not in New York, because everything I was auditioning for, I was just putting down on tape. They're sending it to LA, and then I was flying out there to test or flying out to shoot. So eventually I just moved out there. And I had never been to LA. I'd been to New York many times, living in Toronto. My grandmother was born in New York City. My mother was not born there, but grew up in New York City. So I had a real connection to the city, which is why I went. But when I flew out to LA for the first time for work, I was, you know, I looked around, I saw the palm trees, I smelled the sea air. I was like, this place is awesome.
Yeah. You get used to it.
Yeah. That was it. I fell in love with LA right away. And then, and I had a lot of friends out here too. So, it was an easy move to make.
I feel like that's what pushes it over the edge for, like, if you could live in a few cities, it's usually just the community of people you could find yourself around.
Yeah.
So did you have a lot of people from, like, the New York scene that then transplanted to LA and then they were there? Or
no, it's more Toronto people. Most of the Toronto people, they come to LA. So there was a whole, we all lived at the Highland Gardens. I don't know if you know this place, but it's on Franklin, right by the Magic Castle. And if you're a Canadian actor, it's legendary. It's where
it's like a mecca.
It's like a hotel, you know, long stay hotel, furnished rooms, pretty cheap, right in the heart of Hollywood. And so there was a whole, like, you know, it was like a frat, you know, almost like a Melrose Place of Canadian actors in that place. So when I first got here, I lived there for a little bit, and that was fun. But you had a real community, people you could run lines with. I also played a lot of hockey. There was a whole hockey community out here of Canadians. So Tuesdays and Thursdays, 10:45 in North Hills, we would play hockey every week, twice a week. And that was like a huge grounding force. So that Canadian connection was a big part of helping me transition to being in LA.
Yeah, I'm sure just getting into those rhythms is super helpful. It's almost like may he rest in peace, like Gary Shandling's basketball games you would hear about.
Yeah.
Like the community that kind of, you know, grew around that.
Yeah. Well, the city's so big and there's so much going on. And when you're coming out here, it's so intimidating trying to make it. You're going out on all these auditions and agents. It can be overwhelming. So anything that can ground you and that feels familiar, it's important.
Did you play hockey up in Canada?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
How was that? Was it the kind of thing where, like, because everyone plays hockey, that's just the sport you get into up in Canada, or is it?
Yeah, pretty much. Everybody, all the kids I knew played hockey, you know, when I was growing up, almost all of them. Mm-hmm. My dad was a player.
Oh, was he?
And he was pretty good. Yeah. You know, he played at the University of Denver and had a little run playing semi-pro, you know, in the IHL in the late 60s. And so I was started skating when I was 3. I don't remember a time when I didn't know how to skate.
Right.
So skating for me
it's
is
just in your blood.
Second nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the game, you know, for Canadians is, it's got a, you know, a religious quality. Canadians don't have a lot, you know, we don't have a lot. We're living beside, like, the biggest, richest country in the world that wins all the gold medals. But the one thing Canadians do have is hockey. That's our best game and we're the best at it. So we're Canadians are very proud of their hockey heritage.
Yeah. And it is an interesting thing in Canada that it feels like a lot of funny people come out of it. A lot of people who can do comedy come out of it. And I wonder if there's like a little brother situation going on there, you know, where it's like it's like the old maxim of like, oh, the kid who was picked on or the nerdy guy, and then he grew up and blah blah blah, or girl or whatever. And then, like, what do you think that is? What do you think that Canadian quality is that's like that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I've heard people talk about it before and give their theories. I think that's part of it, you know, when you're it's hard to describe, but when you're living in Canada, you get so much American influence. Obviously, we get all of the TV shows, all the music. I mean, the whole world does, but we're right there, right? And because the language is basically the same, our accent's a little different, and the cultures are pretty similar, it's easy to get overwhelmed by it. And I think Canadians are very protective of their identity and really want to separate themselves as different from Americans. So maybe and also are a little bit defensive about, of course, you know, your neighbor, like I was saying, your neighbor's got the richest, biggest house, is the loudest. Mm-hmm. Some might say most obnoxious. I wouldn't. I love Americans. I mean, I am an American. My mother, you know, is an American, but So there's a lot of stuff in that, and I think I guess it gives Canadians a different perspective on the culture and on themselves, and I'm sure that separation allows them some observations that are good for comedy. Mm-hmm. I think
that sums it up. I'm satisfied with that answer. Are you satisfied?
As am I, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate answer. So when people look up Canadian comedy on Wikipedia, they'll just quote that. I think that'll be great. We'll transcribe it for them.
Very good.
Now, how did Gilmore Girls come about? Where was that in like the timeline of your career? You move out there, you're kind of part of that Canadian community over on Franklin.
Yep.
When does that audition process start?
Well, I'd come off a series for NBC called Cold Feet, which got canceled after 9 episodes. Then I went right from that to another series on CBS, what the hell was the name of that show? I can't remember. But it was another 6 episode kind of check it out. And we did that, and that didn't get renewed. So, and I was a bit heartbroken. You know, when series get canceled, it's a little bit like getting dumped.
Right.
Because you invest all your energy into it and you fall in love with the show, you fall in love with the people. You're hoping that it's going to run forever or at least for a really long time. And so, and then it just gets pulled out from under you and you have no control over it. And so it's like a heartbreak. And I didn't really realize that till later. So there was after those two series ended, there was a year almost where I don't think that I worked. And I don't know if I was depressed or just cautious about reinvesting myself into something. Again, just like a relationship, once you get your heart broken, you know, it's hard sometimes to get back on the horse and get out there and try to love again. So Gilmore Girls came along, and the idea of it being a reoccurring character, but a significant reoccurring character, was appealing to me. So I just went in to audition, you know, like everybody else, and I prepared for it. I mean, I felt like I had a real take on it, and I immediately, you know, the writing appealed to me and I felt the rhythm of it naturally. And then when I went in and I read, and then I walked out of the room and then I heard everybody laugh. And I wasn't like,
that could go one of a few
exactly.
ways.
Exactly. But I knew I'd done a pretty good job. So I was kind of curious. I took it as a good sign.
Yeah.
And later they told me that like they knew right in that moment that I was the guy, like that they'd found that. They found him, and that was sort of a laugh of relief. Like, okay.
Oh, so this was this must have been Mara and Jamie.
Yeah, Mara told me that story.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Right on.
So, but then they went from what I heard. I mean, Mara and Jamie can probably tell you better than I can. But it went out on offer to a couple of different people. I think they told me like Ben Affleck and Ooh. Jason Priestley, like
that's
the network.
Ben Affleck.
Well, the network felt like, you know, they had a hit on their hands, and you know, at the time the WB was kind of hot, and they, you know, they were seeing, you know, who they could get, and it was a reoccurring. So I had to wait for a while. You know, I'd heard that, well, no, you're pinned, you're the guy, but we got to wait and see what happens. So it was a couple of weeks before I finally found out that I got the part, and I'd seen the pilot before I auditioned. So I knew that it was a good show, and well, there's a whole other story to this. And then I went in for the table read.
Yeah. What was that?
Well, that was interesting because, I went in for the table read, and about halfway through, like, you could feel that it was going really well. And Lauren and I looked at each other and there was like real nice chemistry there. And same with Alexis, like you could feel that it was working and it was kind of exciting for me. And I could feel the juice of it, you know, which you don't always feel. Like, you know, the difference, right? When something is really working and humming and hitting, it's like, oh, this is good shit. This mm-hmm. is happening. And then I looked at Lauren and I was like, oh, I know her. And I had remembered that I had tested with her about a year previous for this show called, I think it was called Us. And it was a pilot. It never went. And she was already cast on the show. And I came in from New York to to test with her for chemistry. And I went in there and I just bombed. Like, it was terrible. And she was looking at me, and there was no, like, nothing was happening between us. Like, we couldn't connect. Nothing was going on.
Wow.
So it was, and I went, you know, my manager, agents called me after, how'd it go? I'm like, you know, there's no chemistry between me and that woman. Like, nothing was happening. So, you know. And I didn't get it. And so it was this really strange moment to be reading with Lauren, feeling this amazing chemistry.
The exact opposite of the last experience.
And then think about what had happened.
Did she remember that too? Did you both have the moment where it was like,
I brought it up and she, you know, she was like, ah, nah, nah, nah. Like, she didn't want to talk about it. Something about that whole show was she did not have fond memories of it for whatever reason.
Yeah, it could be a TV show. Yeah. It could be a magazine. It could be this country.
Yeah.
It seems like the universe sort of canceled that show to give you two another shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was the redemption story, was Gilmore Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that first season, Christopher Returns, was, I think, one of your first episodes, if not the first. And you are the first, this is a fun trivia, you're the first person to say the title of the show on the show. That's how you know a show is a good show, is when they say the title.
To the camera.
Oh, really?
I had to stop by to see the Gilmore Girls.
And on the way, I thought I'd stop by and surprise the Gilmore Girls.
Oh. That was one of your first lines. You come into town. And I want to talk about the idea of chemistry, which seems so, like, abstract and hard to pin down. So maybe it's a fool's errand even to try to talk about it. But in terms of, like, scene work with you and Lauren, obviously it was working. And how does that work itself out in the process between two actors? Is it unspoken? Is it something that happens in rehearsal? Is it something that only happens when the cameras turn on?
I mean, it's different every time, I think. I mean, part of you have to find a way to have chemistry, especially when you're playing lovers, right? Or whatever you're playing, to be honest. You have to find it. Even if you hate the person, there's still a chemistry in that needs to be real. You know, with Lauren and I, you know, it was just there. Like, we liked each other. When we read with each other, it just felt natural what was going on. And I think both of us are pretty good with story, meaning we understand the scene and play the scene knowing where it needs to go. But also, I mean, Lauren's very good with surprising you. So she's a very alive actress and does it different. You know, every take can be a little bit different. So you kind of have to stay on your toes. That helps with chemistry. And both of us were willing to engage in that place. And I think also it's just like you when you have a show that you feel like is really working, and this, you can feel the importance of the, I mean, that character, obviously, when Christopher comes in, he's the father, like, you feel the importance of that needs to work. And it's sort of crucial for the story. You kind of just lean into it. And so that's what I felt was happening. We both wanted it to work, but it was easy, to be honest with you. And some of the stuff was talked about off camera, you know, like the kissing and all that stuff. And I think that's, you know, the thing, you just, you know, she's an attractive woman and hopefully she was attracted to me and you know, you
it looked
you,
like she was.
Here you are, and it's like, it's okay, it's playtime and let's enjoy this. Right. You know, let's have a good time. Let's flirt, let's play, let's make out, let's do all this. And I think when I was first doing that stuff, like, it was very confusing for me. You know, but the older you get, the more you're able to get clear about the boundaries and just, you know, come into it, enjoy it.
You mean earlier on in your career, the show?
Yeah, early on in my career, you know, it was harder to navigate. Like, when you're kissing pretty girls on screen, it's like you're kissing a pretty girl. And it's like, and if you're a single guy, you're like, and it feels good. And you're like, I want more of that. And am I in love with this person? What's going on? And you get all confused.
You're crossing your fingers, it gets renewed.
Yeah, exactly.
You forget the cruise there.
Yeah, and the older you get, the more you learn to get clear about that, because you can feel the danger of letting your mind spin, and that it's important to keep it professional. That said, when the camera's rolling, you kind of got to go all in.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting thing too, because, like, violence in a TV show or movie is not like violence in real life. People wearing squibs, the gun has blanks in it, what, it's a fake gun, whatever. Or same thing about any special effect or anything like that, but something like physical connection like that, like, it's kind of the approximate of the real life thing.
Yeah.
So it must be like a really weird, kind of dangerous, tricky territory to kind of dip your toes in and out of.
It's really tricky. And yeah, it's but it's fun. You know, once I started to feel comfortable with it, I would try to enjoy it. And everybody's got their own boundaries. Like the first show I did, I remember we did this take and I was lying on the couch. This is not Gilmore Girls, but I won't name what the show was. And the actress was lying on top of me. And the whole idea, the scene was we start making out and it gets hot and then we, you know, fade out. And the idea is it's leading to cut two. We're in, you know, after commercial break, we're in bed naked.
Right.
So we do the first take and the director's like, great, you know, but this is supposed to lead to sex. So it needs to be hotter. So I was like, yeah, no problem. So take two. And I'm, you know, just naturally, like I put my hands right on her ass. And I just stick my tongue down her throat. Like, I'm not even really thinking about it, right? I'm just like, yeah, it's got to be hot. So I kind of go for it. Mm-hmm. Her husband is on set, right?
Oh.
Did you know this?
I did, but I wasn't even really thinking about it,
yes,
you know? It was just like, I'm kind of in the moment.
Sure.
And then she gets up, you know, and I can see it's like cut. She gets up off me, and I can see she's like thinking, you know, brain's turning. She walks around the couch, and I can feel it coming. And she just looks at me, and she's like, that can't happen. And I was like, gotcha. Now, other situations I've been in, you know, you negotiate the tongue. Are we tonguing? Are we not tonguing? What's
happening? That's the title of your first book, by the way, Negotiating the Tongue.
Negotiating the Tongue. And so that is a negotiation sometimes, or sometimes it's just like you see what happens and you do or you don't, or you try, you know, whatever. But, you know, I've been lucky. I've got to work with some amazing women in my career, and they've all been great about all of that stuff and really cool. And I try to be obviously very respectful.
And it must be easier on a show like Gilmore, where it's probably literally one of the longest running roles you've ever, well, now spanning like 16 years,
yeah,
or whatever, 16 or 17 years. So there's probably a shorthand that develops there too.
Yeah.
Not only in like your relationship with Lauren, but then your relationship with Alexis or even Scott to some degree, and just kind of like the dynamics of those.
Yeah. Yeah. Early on, you're feeling it out. Mm-hmm. And everything's new and exciting. But then, you know, in later seasons, I mean, especially with a 22 episode season where you're working for 9 months, I mean, not for me so much because I was in and out, but for those guys, they're there at work all day, every day, and they're tired. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, all of that stuff is great, but you're also just trying to get through it. I mean, you got a lot of pages to get, and especially with Gilmore Girls, and, you know, I'm sure you heard all this stuff. The scripts are so long, you got to talk so fast. And we were always there, you know, in Warner Brothers lot on a Friday night. It was like us on whatever studio we were in the West Wing next door, there at 2, 3, 4 in the morning on Friday nights, trying to wrap up, you know, our week's work. So, but yeah, you just, you know, at a certain point, that's it. It's a weird thing between action and cut. It can be really, you know, you go for it. But otherwise, sometimes on set, it's just like, oh my God, okay, here we go. It's work,
long day, trying
to get through it. And it's not sexy. It's not necessarily even fun. And it's just, yeah, it's work.
Yeah. So the beginning of the show, you had a recurring role.
Yeah.
You had a few episodes in the first season. And when did you realize that the show had legs? I mean, the show got renewed for the second season, but then it got renewed for a third and a fourth and a fifth. And at what point in the process, if you can even remember, like, did you all, maybe even all collectively realize, oh, I think we have something here?
Well, I mean, I was always a little bit separate because I was coming in and out, and I was doing other work and pursuing other things. So, I was just along for the ride, really. And I was happy to have the job. I certainly liked the show a lot, and I liked working with those guys. I mean, I could feel right away that the show was good. I mean, that doesn't mean that it's going to stick around, but you know, when I filmed my episode of the first season and then watched it on TV, I was like, this is really good. And I could see that, you know, all of the elements of the show were working, and I could see that my character was really working. So I was confident that he was going to come back and have, you know, good, interesting storylines. But no, it's, you know, it's, it was 1 year at a time. I think past three or four, you kind of knew that it was going to run as long as it wanted to, as long as Amy and Dan wanted it to run, as long as Lauren and Alexis wanted it to run, which is a nice situation to be in. But mm-hmm. I was always, you know, never sure, quite sure how much they were going to use me. And every year that was a negotiation. And the truth is, I'm not sure Amy even knew, because, you know, we would get calls and it's like, well, yeah, we want to use them for, we think, for this amount of episodes. And it's like, well, what are the dates? It's, we don't know. What's the story? Well, I don't want to talk about it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what's going on here? And I'm like, oh, well, what's going on is, you know, she's got to write 22 episodes of the show and she doesn't know. How, you know, it's like she's kind of, they're making it up. They have an idea. Right. They have it sketched out, I guess. But especially as they're going along in the seasons, it must get to a point where, you know, you're kind of doing it on the fly. Because we'd get those scripts the day before. I mean, I would get them delivered sometimes the night before, the day before, then go in for the table read. And then you're at work and you got a 7-page scene. And they did a lot of oneers, you know. So, I mean, that's high stakes. It's a lot of pressure. It's like 7 pages. It's one take. You got a lot of tries at
it. It's word perfect.
It's got to be word perfect. And I'm showing up. I'm off the bench. You know what I mean? Like, I'm coming in. Lauren's been, you know, working nonstop. So she's in the flow. And I got to step into that flow quickly and catch up. That was the tricky part for me. And it always took me a few takes if it was, you know, my first day back for mm-hmm. a while to kind of get up to speed. And the directors were always like, it's great. Just faster. Like, I can't do it any faster.
Has anyone ever said slower, David?
Well, that's the interesting thing. For the first time in this new incarnation on mm-hmm. Netflix, I mean, I don't know how much I can say, but I was doing a scene and Amy was directing and she comes into the room and she says, I think you can really take your time with this moment.
Wow.
I was like, what? I had never heard that before. And I did notice, like, in the whole scene that she was really giving it a lot more air. And so I let go a little bit of that, that style and let it flow in a bit of a different way. And I mean, it's still there. It's inherent in the writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to say it quickly, you know, when you read it, it just has that natural flow. But there were times where you could feel you wanted some space or take a moment or think about it. But part of it is on Netflix. There's no time constraint to the episodes. When you're doing it on network television, it's got to come in at, you know, 43 minutes or whatever it is. So those pauses, they're getting cut out anyway.
Right.
Right. They just don't have time for it. They only have, you know.
That's really interesting to hear that, like, even in the new revival episodes where there might be some of the same melodies, but just a slightly different tempo, or at least the, you know, the economy for it, for something like Netflix, where it's like, it can be like 91 minutes if it needs to, it can be 88 minutes or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That, yeah. And I think that changes things. And, yeah, I did notice, yeah, Amy was very happy on set. So I think there was something about the atmosphere, that working in that atmosphere where you're not under those same kind of constraints, mm-hmm. that was liberating for her and for all of us.
That's awesome. And that's what we've gotten the vibe from everyone we've talked to who's done the revival, is like, there's a different kind of energy now where people seem more grateful, or maybe there's just a little bit more an element of fun or rediscovery even in doing those new episodes. So that's very cool to hear.
Well, it's also, I'm sure you're hearing this as well, it's like, I don't think anybody really thought that it was going to become what it has become, right? I mean, people, we knew that people love the show, but, you know, 5, 6, whatever years later, 7 years later, that it was still going to be watched, still being talked about. And, you know, and I guess it's all of the people who watched it when they were in high school are now writing for BuzzFeed and Huffington Post. And
definitely,
so
for,
you know,
BuzzFeed.
What I mean?
Yeah.
They're bringing it back and talking about it. And obviously the Netflix thing, when they put it on Netflix, that helped. So I think there was a real appreciation of what it meant in people's lives and how important it was. And it it's hard to have perspective when you're doing the show. And I think because you're just trying to
keep up,
you're just trying to keep up with it, and it's scary, and it's a lot of work, and it's you know, 12, 14 hours a day working with the same people all the time. I don't care how even tempered you are, people get on your nerves, you know, and it's just like it you can lose that perspective. Yeah. So I think coming back, it was nice. Exactly what you said, to feel the gratitude for all that the show has given people.
Mm-hmm. So for, you know, speaking of, what do we call it? The tutelage of the tongue. What's your book called? The Taming of the Tongue? Something like that.
When it comes to
the negotiation.
Negotiating
of the tongue.
The tongue.
Negotiating
there it is.
The tongue.
Volume one. Yeah. The David Sutcliffe story. when it comes to that, and it comes to, like, because you've done a variety of work in your career, and this is probably some of the most language-specific work of your career in terms of meter, tone, specificity. How, as an actor and as a performer, where you want to make the character your own voice and bring what you have to a character within the framework of it is do not, not don't. And if you say don't, then we're going to, you know, do another take. How do you make that your own?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I struggled with that. And then I gave over and just trusted the process, you know, trusted that, okay, I'm going to just do what they say. I'm going to say this as fast as I can. I'm going to get through it. I'm going to try to stay as connected as I can. Try to be funny. Try to be as real as I can, and see what happens. It's a lot of the time it was not the way I would want to naturally play it, but the writing is not like natural in a way. So you have to conform to the style. It's like, you know, like Shakespeare, you got to go with what it is. And the writing was specific. Amy knew what she wanted. She knew what she was going for. And once I saw it, I believed it. Like, I saw it on TV. I was like, okay, that works. And then I would just give over to it. And there was times that I, you know, would resist, and I think other people would resist because it felt forced or not fun, you know, because there wasn't that space to play. But yeah, you just you know, sometimes, you know, I heard one actor say, sometimes you're doing your thing, and you're fully creative, and that's what you're adding to the process. And other times you are there as an actor to serve the vision of the director, in this case, the showrunner. And that's what I felt it was. For me, I was really there to serve Amy's vision. And, you know, when those scripts would come in and you see how good they were, you'd start to trust that, yeah, maybe that's the best thing to do here. Just serve what she's doing. She seems to know what she's doing.
And it's interesting to hear too, that there was like a bit of a resistance maybe at the beginning of like getting into those rhythms and tones, and then an eventual like giving over from that resistance.
Well, yeah, you want to, I mean, because this is me, this is how I want to play it. And you're like, a lot of it was just moments, stillness, right? Like that connection that you want, that was completely eliminated, right? It's very obviously a very talk driven show. So, but yeah, you just kind of get rid of it. The interesting thing was after that, I mean, I would always find myself having to not go too fast on other shows.
Yeah, I was about to ask, like, how that affected like future work. And
totally.
Stuff.
Like, I had to stop myself from, like, it doesn't need to be that fast. You can take these pauses. You can take your time with it, like all of that stuff. Like it definitely put something in my head where everything's got to be fast, everything's got to be quick, and so it took me some time to unlearn what I had learned and relax into a different style with different shows.
After the unlearning, was it easy to sort of jump back into that rhythm when you did the revival, or was it still that thing of being like, oh, okay, I need to relearn, and then they told me now to unlearn it for this scene, or was it? Did you feel comfortable coming back to?
I did. No, it's a good question, because when I got the script delivered, I was like, okay, like, I don't know what this is going to be. I don't even know. Am I going to be able to do it? I don't know. And it was like no time had passed. I mean, the writing was the same, you know, the same quality. same style. And I just immediately was like, okay, here we are again. Yeah, this is what it is. And it felt really easy and natural. It's, you know, I worked it with it a little bit more probably than I did when I was doing the show in preparation, because, you know, it had been a long time. But once we got in there shooting it, it literally felt like no time it had gone by. It was like here it just was another day. And it ended up being really easy and fun, actually.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you have a preference for working style now after having done so much in terms of like how you like the process, whether it's collaborative with the writer and director or more like an instrument being played in an orchestra like it is on Gilmore?
Well, there's something about, you know, being an instrument that's being played, it's a nice way of putting it, that that surrender that you just give over, that I don't want to say it absolves you of responsibility, but you don't you're not so attached to your big creative choices, and you're just part of something, and you just kind of give over and you do your job, and there's something that's actually really nice about that. The show I did in Canada was like a cop show, and that was a completely different situation where I pretty much got to do whatever I wanted. I was the lead of the show. The writing was the writers knew the scripts were coming in, not always totally ready. So they were happy for us to, you know, fiddle with it and find it in rehearsal. But that's a whole other issue. You know, you feel more the onus on you to make it work. Like this is going to live or die by my performance, by my choices. But ultimately that for me is more rewarding creatively, because you feel even if you're bad, it's like it's me being bad. It's my choice. It's my mistake. There's a lot more.
And you can own that.
Yeah, and you can own it and you can play. And that's really why I got into it. You know, I mean, it's fun to play. And to experiment and to dive in there and to risk being terrible and to go for it and to make stuff up and to be in the moment and change the lines. I mean, that's the way that I like to work. That said, there's nothing better than having great writing, and which I, you know, there's not a lot of that out there. I mean, people ask why there's not a lot of great movies, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot more great TV shows now, but it's all about the writers. I mean, and it's a hard thing to do is sit down and write these scripts and come up with all these ideas and the stories. And so when you get it, you feel, you know, that's really the best part of it. And so that was, like I said, the best thing about coming back is like, oh, here, this is what it's like to work with great writing. That's fun.
And that's such an interesting concept too, about the idea of like, of making things your own, but then based on the success or failure of it, just the idea of ownership being its own virtue is very cool. Do you feel like you've learned more from like your successes or failures?
Both, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, I'm 47 years old and I've had ups and downs in my career and personally, and you know, you start to gain a lot of perspective and you see it with distance, and that it's all just this thing that's playing out your life, and you stop being attached to things in the same way that you did when you were young. So I'm grateful for all of it, you know, all of the experiences that I had on the shows that were successful and the shows that were not, and the times that I was really good in a scene and the times that I was, you know, really bad. I have a lot of forgiveness for myself and all of it. So I kind of say yes to it all. But obviously the successes are special, you know, and they're unique. And being a part of something like Gilmore Girls, which has become a classic show and is impacted so many people and is beloved by so many people, and that I, you know, I go out in the street and I'm recognized every day of my life. Like, that's when you start out as a young actor, you know, the idea that you're going to be a part of something like that it's exciting. And I feel a tremendous amount of gratitude for what Gilmore Girls has given me, for the experience and for the exposure and for the love that I get from the fans. Because even though, you know, a lot of people hate my character. When they see me in real life, it's this. I get nothing but love. You know, there's just such an openness, and it's fun. It's fun to be on the receiving end of that kind of attention.
So you haven't had any like weird or negative experiences with like, I hate you, Christopher.
You ruined it.
You ruined Luke and Laura. That's great.
Well, I do online, but I can see that it's all in fun. You know what I mean? They're not really, you know, that serious about it. It's all, they know it's a TV show. They know that I'm not actually that guy. So
I will say, as we've gotten further into this series and the arc of Christopher's progress, because currently we're wrapping it up. We're almost done with season 7, the final season. And we're going to, you know, lead that right into the Netflix episodes. I will say the amount of hot takes and opinions regarding Christopher has accumulated exponentially in our email inbox with that, as there's more and more nuance to the story.
Well, and there's more and more Christopher in scene in 6 and 7, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure that's going to impact the viewers and how they feel about me.
I wonder, in season 6 and 7, because there's so much Christopher, were you given directions on how, in the sense of like, I feel like earlier in the series, Christopher and Lorelai's relationship is very much like, oh, he's not an awful guy, but like, were you always told like he's pining for her? You secretly want to play the fact that he's like in love with her still, or is that something that developed later?
No, that was always, Amy was really clear about that actually, because I asked her that early on and she kept reiterating that. It's like, no, you want her back. You've always wanted her back. You've always loved her. You're pining for her. Wow. Like that is the subtext of
every scene,
of everything. Wow. Yeah. Like, so, you know, which was, I didn't always want to play that, you know, because it was sort of like, I'm over her. Fuck that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, because it's vulnerable to play that longing, especially when it's not being received or it's unrequited. But that was the intention.
Wow. So that's the through line.
Yeah.
That's canon, man.
It's official. But
Oh, were you going to say something?
No, I was interested in that, really.
Yeah, because that almost, in a way, subtextually gives the answer to a lot of questions that are raised in the show. And even the idea, I feel like it must be so fun to play a character that's able to have such dynamic range over the show, from absent dad to on again, off again boyfriend to Lorelai to temporary husband to friend. And to me, the most striking thing about the character of Christopher, if I may, is the friendship between Christopher and Lorelai, which is the chemistry between David and Lauren. You know, like that was in and of itself such a great special effect in the show. So that was just such a lovely thing to see. And especially as it developed and grew over time, it never seemed false or trite. That was a really cool thing to observe.
Yeah. No, that's interesting to hear you say that. You know, the thing that's interesting is that you never really know where it's going. Like, so you get these scripts and it's like, you know, God coming down and here's your fate.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have attachments to certain, like the end of season 2, I was devastated.
Sherry
when we
pregnant.
Read that. Yeah, yeah. Sherry's pregnant. I was like, what? No, I do not like that. What is going on? You know, I was it was jarring to read that. So, and it's a weird experience to have, and you get really attached. I mean, I did. I get emotionally attached to these characters in the situation.
So in a way, you're rooting for Christopher's success as much as anybody.
Of course. I want him to be beloved. And I mean, I just did a thing where, you know, they kept giving me direction to play it like meaner. And I'm thinking, no, I want this character to come back. I want the audience to like this guy. Like I want, and it was a really, you know, tricky thing. So, I'm rooting for Christopher. I want him to be a good guy. And so when Amy would write him in ways that he was letting her down or letting the kid down, it was always, it was painful for me.
I'm sure.
You know, because I wanted to represent this character in the best way that I could. But that's also, again, you're there to serve the show. But I don't, you know, in the moment, I don't give a shit. Like, I'm like, you're fighting for your character. You're fighting for your point of view, which is kind of your job as an actor. Ultimately, you have to, you do, you know, give over. But
yeah. And especially interesting to like hear, even just from your perspective, because of course you're in the thick of it, like just the idea of like, yeah, I think Christopher might be in game for Lorelai. I think this might, because yeah, like in the at the time, and you're in like second season of a show, that's just as possible as anything else, as anything with Luke or any of the other characters, Mike's Medina or Alex or any of that.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I always wondered, I always felt like the fantasy is that the family gets back together, that that's actually what the fans want. And on some level, I mean, clearly they want Lorelai and Luke, but that there's some other, through Alexis's point of view, the child wants her parents to get back together.
Right.
Right. Like that's a kind of a primal thing that was played with. But it never made sense to me that the show would end that way. Like I never felt like, I mean, I didn't know and nobody told me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't ask, you know, where it was going from year to year.
And we don't know that the revival doesn't end that way.
We don't know that the revival doesn't end that way.
We don't know anything.
We don't know anything. I don't know anything. But yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of the revival, I know you can't give anything away, but real quick, how does it end? I'm just kidding. What are the final four words? Yeah, but how many episodes are you in the revival?
I'm just in one episode.
Oh, okay.
I think I can tell you that.
It seems like a lot of people are in one episode, but because they're bigger episodes, we don't know how much involvement that is. We don't know.
The impact and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, I'll just say this. I mean, you guys can imagine from the way things ended in season seven, like, you know, Christopher's, a lot of resolution had taken place. So his role in the situation is, there's no immediate dynamic there that needs resolution. So, but he is there and there's some, you'll see.
Of course.
Speaking of the way things did end in season seven, I'm wondering, because, I mean, the whole crew sort of changed over in season seven with the writers and the directors and whatnot. Did you feel that shift from your angle as well, or was it just kind of like, I'm going back to work and there's a different director?
No, it was different.
Yeah.
I mean, Amy is a very powerful presence.
Right.
And the writers, you know, of season seven did their best to try to, you know, emulate her as best they could. And they did a great job. But, you know, Amy is Amy and she's magic.
Right.
And not just in her writing, but in her presence, you know, not that she was on set every day, but, you know, she had a very strong take on the show. And I mean, like amazingly powerful, like, this is what I want. Mm-hmm. This is what, and she, like, you ask her any question about the show, like, she's thought it through. And she knows, like I was saying with the Christopher stuff, like she's really clear on who that guy, you know, who he is and what she wants and what she thinks he's thinking, which I wasn't always in alignment with. But so, yeah, season seven was different, but it was fun and good. And, you know, it was weird because you could feel like, this is probably the end. Like if Amy's gone, like it's probably not going to go on for too much longer. So there was a bit of, I think, I don't know, just awkwardness or maybe some sadness or not really knowing how to feel about it, you know?
And it must be so weird too, to play all those scenes.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you're married to her, but it's like, oh, this probably isn't gonna, where's this going? You know? Or was there even the thought in your mind like, oh, I guess this is how this ends. We're married. Because in a way, you might think like, oh, everyone's going to hate me now.
Well, at that point, I didn't really care if everybody hated me. I kind of liked it. It's fun to be hated. Well, you know, the funny thing is like on season seven, I'll tell you this story, is like they offered me all episodes produced, right? Oh, wow. So it's like 22 episodes. So, and for some reason I've always struggled with, you know, my acting career, whether I even want to be doing it. You know, I have this whole, like, I'm not sure that I even, like, I mean, I just recently decided, like, I'm out. Like, I'm done. Yeah.
Wait, you're done with acting?
I'm done. Yeah, I decided to retire. I mean,
is this a Gilmore Guys exclusive?
This is probably an exclusive. I think I tweeted it indirectly, but I haven't really talked about it publicly.
What led to that decision?
I'm just, my heart's not in it anymore, you know? And, you know, I've been working, so it's, you know, it's not for lack of opportunity or for work or money, but it's just there's no passion in it for me anymore. So, and I have other things that I'm very passionate about, and it just, I could feel it was just time to let go of one thing and then step all the way into this other thing, because at a certain point, if you want to do something else, you have to give all of your energy to it, especially for the first couple of years as you create that thing and build it up and make it your new livelihood.
That's such an interesting idea. I mean, I was even thinking about this the other day, like the idea of like a corporation or something. You've never heard of a corporation say like, you know what, we're pretty profitable and we're doing really well, but my heart's not in it. Let's shut down Starbucks or whatever right. The case may be. But it sounds like there's kind of something like that going on for you. So like what are your other passions now? What are those going towards?
Well, I'm a Cornergetics practitioner. Cornergetics is a somatic, like a body psychotherapy that uses physical techniques like hitting, punching, kicking, and breathing to help people access and express emotions held in their body and hidden from their awareness, unconscious emotions. It's a really, you know, powerful and effective way to learn things about yourself that you do not know. And I fell in love with, I was always interested in therapy, like most actors, since my early 20s, this idea that there was things going on in my unconscious that I didn't know about that were impacting and influencing all of my decisions and my behavior. And I was determined. So I was like, well, I'm not really conscious. I'm not really free. I'm not making these choices. They're being made for me on some level. I'm, you know, it's like I'm in the matrix here.
Yeah.
How do I get out of the matrix? So, I started doing a lot of therapy, and then I came upon this therapy in my early 30s and then started doing it.
During the show?
Was it during the show? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I think I was 30, 31 when I first started. And then I got into it seriously around 35. I started doing work in groups, and there was, I met a certain facilitator, teacher, that I immediately had this very strong instinct, like, I want to know everything she knows. I want to be able to do what she does. And like, that was it. And after that, the acting in a way became secondary.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that that's really what was going on at the time, because it was like, I was doing great. You know, I was in my mid 30s and I was working like crazy. My career was going well and I wanted to exploit it, but I could feel that all my attention was going to this thing. And so she started a training program and I went to her training program. I started in 2008 and graduated 2012. It's a part-time thing. So mm-hmm. I was acting and doing this, and then I graduated. And just as I graduated, I got this series back in Toronto. And when I wasn't shooting the series, I started leading my own groups and workshops. And over the course of a year or two, I started to discover that I really loved it and that I had a real aptitude for it. And I built up a community, a vibrant, you know, community in Toronto pretty quickly. And I was like, is this my thing? Is this my new thing? Is this what I want to be doing? And it felt really good because I was, you know, really contributing and giving and helping people and feeling like I was really in my flow. And, but I was, you know, the idea of giving up acting to do that full time seemed, it just didn't seem realistic. But now I'm at a place where I'm ready. I just became ready to do that. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I mean, not exclusively. Sure. There's other things I want to do. Like, I made a film and I want to make some more.
Directed a film?
Well, I made a documentary about this kind of therapy called This Is a Thing That I'll Pimp. Group.
Oh, yeah. It's time for pimping.
groupdocuseries.com. groupdocuseries.com. Go. It's a 11-part series about a one-week group therapy retreat. It's really weird, but if you get into it, I promise you, it will blow your mind. It will take you. It's unlike anything you've ever seen before. Very powerful. It's you know, goes in. It's the kind of therapy that goes in really, really deep. It's very intense. It suits my personality really well. And yeah, this is what I'm into. So, you know, I just kind of gave over and surrendered to it. And it was a big, huge life change, terrifying call to my agent to say, I'm out, I'm out of the game, and I'm not crazy.
He said, I understand. Have a nice day.
Was it? Well, there was, you know, it's funny because both my agent and my manager actually, I'd had other moments in my career. I was like, I'm out. I don't want to do this anymore. It's no fun for me. And my manager would really push back. But this time he didn't push back at all. Hmm. He just really listened. And
because it's been the same guy the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I must really be clear, you know, like I'm like, in other words, he can really feel how strong this is in me. And that's why he's not pushing back. So that was a really good sign for me that I was making the right decision. But of course, you know, I'm like, am I, you know, you question it. You know, the next day I completely freaked out. it's like, what am I doing? I can't do this. And then after that, you know, I felt nothing but excitement about, you know, the future. So
that's cool though, especially like at this point in your career and your life to still do things that are challenging, kind of scary. It reminds me of that story Jane Fonda told of like, she actually did Ben Schwartz's improv show. She did an improv show for the first time. Jane Fonda, did it. 'Cause she said, oh, it sounded really scary and weird.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try it. How do you feel like Core Energetics, you know, other than kind of gradually over time, taking your primary interest away from it, how do you feel like it affected your work and your career?
Well, it definitely made me a better actor.
I mean, really?
You know, because the whole idea of the therapy is to get you into feeling, right? Like talk therapy is, you know, you can sit and talk. You can talk about your problems, about your mother and your father and all the things that happened to you. And you can kind of do the math of the psychology and put the pieces of the puzzle together to kind of understand, you know, what you absorbed when you were a kid and how that makes you who you are now. But Core gets into what actually you're feeling, mm-hmm. right? So it goes right in, and it's got different tools that it uses, and you work with the group. So it's a visceral, you know, body thing. And so, I mean, that's what acting is about. You know, you want to be in touch with your feelings, all of your feelings, being present with your pain, with your fear, with your rage, having no shame about it, having access to all of those feelings, just like a painter has access to all the colors on their palette. So for me, it was the best acting training that that I had, to be honest. And I did do an acting class with this work in Toronto that was became really popular. So I'll probably do one here. I mean, actors love it. You know, because they don't have any problem with the weird. Actors get right into it.
They're down for it. They're down for whatever.
They're down for whatever. So
now I'm going to be disappointed if in Gilmore Girls: A Year in the Life, if it's not just Christopher teaching Rory how to do Core Energetics and guiding her through that. It's going to be kind of a bummer.
Yeah,
that'd be cool. Oh man. Well, and I will say this. You know, kind of wrapping up Gilmore discussion. And I know we said we wouldn't quiz you on anything, but there is a question that we ask all of our guests, people who have worked on the show and people who are just here to talk about the show. And that question is?
Of the boyfriends that Rory has throughout the series, are you a team Jess, a team Dean, or a team Logan?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I gotta say, I'm Team Dean.
Oh, really?
Yeah, another one.
Yeah, I'm Team Dean.
It seems like a lot of people who are from the cast are Team Dean.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're all great guys.
Of course.
Like they're all super cool guys. But you know, the problem is, Jared came in. He was so young. He was the first one, right? And I worked with him quite. I didn't work with Jess so much, but. He's just such a sweet kid,
yeah.
You know, and so sincere and genuine. It's hard not to fall for that guy.
Of course.
So, it was, you know, even playing the dad, like I could feel in the role, like, yeah, I'm okay with this. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? If my daughter marries this guy, it's good. It's a good
this would
kid.
Be a good thing.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm team Dean.
Another check mark in the team Dean column. I will say, when we had Milo on the show,
uh-huh.
who played Jess, he also alluded to something similar in the sense of, he said, oh yeah, I think I'm kind of retired now. I think, you know, similar to you. Yeah, he was like, you know, I've done a lot in my work, in my life. And then he just got that NBC show and it got picked up to series. But, you know, he's kind of, it's funny to hear that you both were in sort of a similar place.
Well, it's a weird game. I know Hollywood's a weird game, you know, and it's like you are in it. And especially in television, and there's a lot of money out there. And that's the tough part of it, right? Like, it's a lot of money sitting out there. You get on a network show, you know, where you're doing 22 episodes a year and you're getting that big paycheck and you're thinking about the big house you can buy and the car and all that stuff. And, but there's a lot you give up, obviously, for that. It's a lot of time and it doesn't matter what show you're on eventually, especially on network, it does become a little bit rote, you know, a little bit uninspiring at times. So I think when I was a younger person trying to make it, it was like fine. But you get to my age and you just realize like I don't have any time to do anything that I'm not passionate about, that I'm not fully into. I don't have time to spend with people that I don't love or really want to be around. I mean, you feel the preciousness of your time. And so you want to use it as best you can. And all of the other stuff, like the accolades and the money and the attention, all the ego gratification stuff starts to kind of fall away. That's the great thing for me about getting older. It's like I've let go a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. And all that stuff too is so temporary and sort of, you know, a footnote to your actual identity rather than what your identity is.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
It's good to realize that at some point. Man, and do you feel like too, because what you're describing sounds like the instinct of an artist too, to only do the stuff that you are interested in, to only do the stuff that you find fulfillment or passion is. Do you feel like there's another arc too, where it's just like the ebbs and flows of what the industry has, because it's a very different industry now than what it was, say, like when you did your first guest spot on Friends or something, even in terms of like economics and like the way network, you know, does with web, does with Crackle or Netflix or Hulu. Like, do you feel like that's been disillusioning too?
No, actually, if anything, I think it's the opposite. I mean, I think it's a great time to be an actor. There's so much good stuff out there, especially on television. I mean, there's good series everywhere you look, you know. And it's not like movie, you know, even those indie movies back in the day, like you do, they might be a great indie movie, but nobody really saw it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these TV series, they're getting viewed and they're there forever and people are picking them up on Netflix maybe 3-4 years later. So I think it's the golden age of television. And I think it's a good time to be an actor. I think, you know, people are getting paid less for sure than they used to. The climate is different. I think there's a lot of shooting less episodes, you know, but I think overall that's healthier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, once I was done with Gilmore Girls, I remember saying to my agent, I don't want to do 13 episodes max. Like, I don't want to be locked into 22 episodes because it just eats you up and it's impossible to be creative every day. So, but that said, and that's part of what happened to me. It's like, what show is out there of all these amazing shows? What show would I really want to be on? And what would I give up doing this other thing that I love for? And it was like, maybe Game of Thrones and, you know, Better Call Saul. Like, that was kind of it. Everything else was like, eh.
You know? I could see you as your king in Game of Thrones. I could see you ruling a kingdom.
Yeah, it would be fun.
That would track.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, that you just feel whatever I needed to learn from my experience as an actor, I learned and I got it. And now it's time for something different. That said, not to say I'll never come back. Like, I do have a feeling that once I really establish, you know, my core work and build my workshops and do all the things I want to do there, which will take a number of years to really build it up, that once it's established, that'll create some space for maybe me to come back and to know that I can come back and do it for no other reason that I want to. And I think it's going to be fun. Like, it won't be about the money. It won't be because I need a job. Mm-hmm. It'll just be like, yeah, this will be an interesting experience. It'll, you know, it touches me. It's a good show. So if that comes up, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years down the line, sure. I'm totally open to it. And my agents are aware of that.
But for now, like, Gilmore Girls is kind of an interesting kind of bookending experience in a way, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Starting in 2000 and shooting in 2016, you know, for the last time, possibly the last time. I mean, did you get the sense that these were like the last episodes they were going to produce?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a great time. So who knows what could happen, you know?
Are there any other, like, you know, just kind of reminiscing on the show? And if there's not, that's okay. Are there any like sort of like fun set stories you remember? Any particular days that kind of crystallized the highs or the lows of the experience of working on Gilmore?
You know, I mean, I had obviously had a lot of fun with Lauren. You know, she's just great to work with and crazy and in the best way. But there's something about the scenes. Like I always would have these scenes with Alexis playing the father. Daughter scenes were always so special to me for some reason. I don't have kids. And, you know, I was a young man then in my early 30s and not even really thinking about having kids. But the idea that I could have a 16-year-old daughter, you know, when I was 32 years old. And she was so open and vulnerable. That those scenes always, like the cotillion ball. Mm-hmm. Like that whole thing. Like when I think about that, I could cry.
Do you have like a paternal pride for it?
Totally. Totally. Like and that was part of what was so beautiful about the show is like you feel like when you'd walk, it was like a vortex and you'd walk into it and then you were in an alternate reality and it was real. And everybody, I mean, obviously you have to agree on that. Like everybody kind of plays their role, but there was something, and I think that's part of the beauty of the show. That doesn't exist everywhere. When I did Will and Grace, early on in their first season, you could feel that. Like you walked onto that set and as soon as they started reading, it's like, whoa, this is like a whole thing that they've created and it's on fire in there. And they just step right into it and you step into it and then you're in it. And it was very similar with Gilmore Girls. And I remember, I think like my favorite memory is it was going to shoot that final scene, Sherry's pregnant scene. And we were out on some farmland, I don't know where exactly we were, and the trailers were parked. So we had to, you know, get in a van, the shuttle and take us there. And I was walking slowly across the field to where the trucks were. And Alexis was coming back from her thing and she just spotted me and she could see that I was sad or I was nervous about the scene or something. And she ran all the way across and just like hugged me. And it was so spontaneous and so childlike and so sweet and so beautiful. And it's exactly what I needed, that she somehow saw that I was, you know, in need of a hug and just ran like a little girl and just gave it to me. There's something about that memory that sticks in my mind is one of my fondest memories from my experiences on the show.
That's so lovely. And it's so funny too, to think about how Alexis now is around the same age you were when you started the show.
It's really weird.
That's trippy, man.
So trippy. It was so trippy to see her with the baby.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, she had the baby on set?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I was only like, I don't know, 5 months ago, you know.
Yeah.
She was still, baby was young.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
So the Bledel name will live on. Well, do you have any?
I'm kind of curious, going back to the audition process, in them casting Chris, do you remember what sort of notes they wanted you to hit? Like, just, I feel like the character of Chris when he's introduced is one thing to Lorelai and an entirely different thing to Rory. Lorelai's very cautious about him. Rory's sort of like, it's my dad, I'm nothing but happy he's here. Do you remember what it was like the first time you were playing that character, if you were told to play it a certain way, or?
Not really. I mean, I went into the audition and I always very rarely ask questions. And if I do, it's usually a really simple question. And I just said, I think I said something like, do you want this played really like up or like high or low or up or down or something indicating like that. And she was like up, you know, which like for me, like fast. And I was like, okay, I got it. Like, it's not a laid back scene. Like we're going to drive it. And that was really it. I mean, that was really the only note that I got, other than the sort of super arc of the character. But and I don't remember. I mean, that obviously a lot of my scenes were with Alexis on that first Christopher Returns. But you know, it was all self-evident, to be honest with you. I mean, I was the dad coming back, and I was trying to do right by her, and I missed her. And I loved her. You know, that was easy to play.
Right.
You know, it was easy to play for both of them. They're both so sweet and lovable. It was just easy to let yourself just fall in love.
I had another question. In half the scenes after season two or whatever it was, where the hell is Gigi?
Yeah, I
know.
Where
is she? what's she doing? She got sentient real quick.
Yeah, I know. That was always a running joke. Where's Gigi? I have no idea.
She's hanging out
Gigi.
With Mr. Kim. Yeah, exactly. It sounds like. Oh, and also, I did want to ask, you know, and this is one of those like nerdy things, but in the season seven fist fight you have with Luke.
Yeah.
Was that all you? Was that stunt? How did that?
No, that
how was
us.
That choreographed?
Yeah, we worked on that for a while. It was fun. Yeah, we came in, we spent an afternoon. We're both pretty physical guys, mm-hmm. you know, both jockey. He was a baseball player, I was a hockey player. So we were ready to go.
Ooh, you were fighting over national pastimes.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a real Canadian versus American fight when you think about it. Take a few steps back.
Yeah, and he was, you know, and we got in there and we started wrestling, and I could feel, we were both feeling like, yeah, this would probably be, I mean, he would take me for sure, but it would be a good fight. You know what I mean? It was fun. Yeah, we rehearsed it and choreographed it. They ended up cutting it down quite a bit, as they usually do. But, you know, obviously when we shot it, it was a ton of...
It was 30 minutes long.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was great. And actually, because we didn't have that much work together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't that many. I'm trying to think, like, how many scenes
did we... He punched you in the face. He came to the apartment, punched you. You got drunk at the vow renewal with him.
Yeah.
But yeah, not a lot.
Not a lot. Yeah. So that was one of our... And that's a, you know, that's also a big part. When you're going to shoot a scene with somebody, it's also the time that you're going to spend in the makeup trailer, like, sitting around. Like, that was, you know, so it was... I remember that scene being really the one where he and I really bonded. It was nice. He's a good dude.
Yeah, it looked pretty great. You know, watching it back.
Yeah, somebody has posted to my Twitter a GIF. I don't know what the official thing is, of me like taking off.
Oh,
like
the scarf.
Walking toward him and taking off the scarf, and I was like, "That's okay. I look pretty badass."
I mean, I don't know if you've been to a site called Tumblr.com, but oh boy, is there a lot of. Pictures, GIFs or GIFs, literature.
Really?
I mean, is that hard to, well, I guess you just answered my question, but like, is that hard to like tune out or not pay attention to? Because the amount of like passion around your performance and your character,
right.
Christopher Hayden, is pretty unbelievable. It's a lot, you know, but I guess you don't engage in that much.
I kind of tune it out a little bit. I mean, I get, you know, Twitter and people tweet me and I try to, you know, reply
have fun,
and have fun with it, all that stuff. But, I mean, look, all that stuff. I'm sort of aware of it, but it's such a world that you open up, and all the videos on YouTube. I mean, I watched a few of those sometimes and, you know,
they're pretty wild, man.
They're pretty wild and it's crazy and they're creative and, you know, people are into it and, you know, God bless them. And I love it. Like I love, like I said, I love the fans. I love the attention. Mm-hmm. You know, people always say to me, is it a pain in the ass? Like, you know, walking around and being recognized, especially being recognized for essentially for one thing. I mean, there's occasionally some other stuff that I've done that I get recognized for, but primarily it's for Gilmore Girls. And I'm like, no, man, like people come up to you with like open and love and they're mm-hmm. just giving you this energy. And it's like, I learned very early on, it's like the best thing you can do is just like receive it and like stay present with them and just like thank people. And you know, 99 times out of 100 people are, you know, cool with the boundaries. They don't push it too much. And they just want a picture. They just, something that's meant so much to them. They just want a second of connection, of closeness.
Yeah.
And I'm always happy to give it to them.
Speaking of fan stuff, I was surprised we didn't see you at the ATX festival last year.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. There was some mix-up. happen. I'm not sure what happened there.
Yeah, I mean, because if anyone, as much as anyone else, deserved to be on that stage with everybody else.
Yeah, I think I was meant to be there. I don't. Yeah, that's a mystery that I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of. I don't know whose end it was on, yeah. But there was apparently that was meant to happen.
Who killed Laura Palmer?
Their people or my people, but.
A Team Luke member with a grudge.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But in a way, it's funny because in a way I felt like, yeah, it's kind of perfect. Christopher shouldn't really, you know what I mean? Like, it's yeah. Like he's...
Keep a safe distance.
Yeah, I don't know. There was something about that that felt right to me, even though I missed seeing everybody. But I got to see everybody at the revival, at the Netflix, at the read-through, which was awesome.
Which episode is it that you're in?
I think it's the last one.
Okay, it's fall.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not 100% sure, but I think so.
Oh, we'll find out.
It seemed to be the script when we read it. I can't imagine that was not the final episode, the way it ended.
Because you shot Luke Danes.
Although, I don't think I shot Luke Danes, exactly. I don't think, I mean, you've probably heard this, that there's a number of endings, and they didn't read the full ending at the read-through, and
they took the final four words out of the script.
There's a whole... I don't really pay any attention to that. What I can say is, like, whew, it was really good. It was very moving, very funny.
Yeah.
And it just felt like, oh, the fans are going to love this.
That's very awesome. Exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on a bigger picture note, besides Cornergetics, what else is left on your bucket list? What do you want to do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think I want to see how big I can make this stuff. Like right now, the workshops I do, the nature of them, you can't really have more than 20, 25 people, right? But I'm trying to imagine, I mean, I have to change the style of it to do workshops at a bigger scale, like 50 or 100 people. I mean, I watched the Anthony Robbins documentary, and it was interesting because, you know, he does it with like 2,500 people. And I had this real instinct, like the way he processes people, it's very similar to what I do. I mean, it's not, the style's a little bit different, but the general tone is the same, like how he's approaching it. And it was a real weird moment to go, similar to when I was like, decided I want to become an actor and watch TV and had a feeling like, oh, I could do that. Watching that, and I was like, I could do that. I mean, I can't do it the way he does it or be quite as dynamic as him, but there's a version, I have a version of that. So I think I'd like to see if I could build up and get like 50, 100 people in it to do workshops. And so larger scale, and then do it around the country.
You know? Like maybe like tour with it a little
tour
bit.
With it. Like could I do 20 cities? Could I go to Portland? Could I go to Atlanta and get like 50 to 100 people at these workshops? And really that's something that would be exciting for me. So that's what I'm focused on. That'll take a number of years probably, you know, to build that, but that's kind of where I'm going. And then after that, I think I do want to make more films, like the documentary that I made about this group therapy retreat. It was a very difficult process because I was in over my head. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was figuring it out as I went. But I'm really happy with the result. It's certainly imperfect, but overall it's quite beautiful. And I got a taste for, and I did everything. Like, I produced it. I directed it. I didn't shoot it. I had a great DP, but I edited it all myself. So I got to, you know, have a mastery of, or at least the beginning of a mastery of a lot of the different elements to filmmaking. So I think I'd like to do more documentaries.
Yeah. That's got to be so satisfying too, just like what you were talking about in the sense of like ownership and just feeling the authorship of a thing. It's almost like, look at this table I built, or I built this house. Like,
exactly.
Made a documentary.
Yeah. I'm very proud of it. And yeah, that just the experience of finishing it and having it out there for the world to see. And you know, and people, you know, I get messages every day from people saying they just watched it and they spent, you know, the whole weekend crying and it really touched them. And so that's obviously very gratifying, you know, to know that you're putting things out in the world. But, you know, similar to Gilmore, every day of my life, whether it's on the streets or on Twitter, you know, people tell me how much that show meant to them, and it's just, it's great.
Is there a certain line that people say a lot more than other, or something they quote something back at you, or is it just like, Christopher, hi?
Yeah, it's just Christopher. Yeah. Oh, man, I love Gilmore Girls. That was my favorite show. You don't understand. You don't understand is what I get all the time. It's like, no, I understand.
Every Wednesday on the WWWB. Yeah. Which is how they had to answer the phones back then, by the way. At the network, people who worked at the WB, because it was Michigan J Frog, was the mascot. So they had to say, welcome to the WWWB, where can I direct your call? Like, that was reception at the network, on a network level, which I find very,
that is funny.
Very entertaining.
Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. This has been such a fun little chat.
Yeah, I feel like I've learned a lot.
It's great to be here. You guys are awesome. I appreciate what you guys are doing, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, we appreciate you. And we could leave this unresolved on a bit of a, dare I say, a David Sutt cliffhanger. Come on.
Nice.
But where can people find you on social media? And then go ahead and you can plug the website again. And then a third question we ask all of our guests is, because Gilmore Girls is so pop culture centric and all the references, what's something in pop culture, whether it be a movie, a TV show, a book, a song, an album, whatever, that you're enjoying right now?
Okay. So should I answer that question first?
However you want to do it.
Sutcliffe David on Twitter. Sutcliffe David on Twitter and on Instagram. My website is about to go up. So if you're interested in my workshops, it'll be davidsutcliffe.net and then groupdocuseries.com. But definitely, you should definitely come check out one of my workshops. They're very cool. They're a lot of fun.
They'll be in which area?
They're going to be mostly in LA. Okay. I mean, between LA and mostly in LA, some in Toronto.
Okay.
And so, yeah, please come and check it out, or watch the documentary, and you can see if it feels right for you. Something in pop culture that I'm consuming right now that I love. The first thing that comes into my mind is Jason Isbell, his latest record, Something More Than Free, I think it's called. He's a country singer, and he's got, I think this is his second, third album out, but he is just fantastic. You don't have to be into country to love this guy. He's an Alabama dude.
Yeah, and I've heard some of his stuff. He's like more authentic country than contemporary country.
Yeah, he's not contemporary country. He's not radio country. He's the real thing, singer-songwriter, super soulful, kind, gentle man. It just comes through. I think he's one of the best artists out there. So I've got him, you know, on my playlist all the time.
Right now, are you a Spotify man, Apple Music?
I just got on Spotify. I love Spotify.
Okay.
Yeah. But
You don't make playlists.
I don't make playlists. Yeah. No, I'm not. So I don't even know how that all works yet. But that's what you do, right? You make a playlist, then people can follow your playlist.
Yeah, I think the idea, it feels pretty open platform, but I think the idea is like, you make like my workout mix or whatever, and then people can follow it.
Right.
And then when you add songs, it's added to their playlist because they're following it or whatever the case may be. My morning mix, my going to work mix or whatever the case is. Someone made a Spotify playlist for all the songs we've like referenced or sung
The
show. So like people do things like that. So it's fun. It's good.
I love it. Yeah. No, I just got into it. So it's an amazing resource for music.
All right. So Jason Isbell.
Jason Isbell. Check him out for sure.
Cool. Well, David, once again, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Gilmore Gabs. One of our best gabs yet, I'd say.
It's the Gilmore Gabs.
Dare I say. So at Sutcliffe David, you can follow him.
One of our best.
And you can see us on the road. I guess we're on the road currently, so check us out.
Hopefully you've already seen us on the road.
Yeah, in Toronto. Yeah. All right, thanks, David.
Thank you
so much. Thank you.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.